Hi, everyone. Welcome to Podcast UFO. Michael Lauck will be joining us in a few minutes. I'm Martin Willis. Today's a special program. It's episode number 50, and it's mostly a science program with Dr. Seth Shostak. He is the senior astronomer of SETI. And so how you doing, Michael?
Good. How are you doing this week?
Good. And what's up for the news this week?
Well, we have a lot, but first I'd like to remind listeners that they can learn more about all of our stories through the links we have provided in the show notes available at podcastufo.com. While there, be sure to sign up for our forums. Now, this week's almost all science-themed news. First of all, we have a weather satellite failure. A National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration severe weather tracking satellite, which covers the eastern part of the United States, has failed. A spare satellite has been activated, though, so there is no immediate danger, despite the fact that it is the beginning of hurricane season.
So I think that's interesting they have a spare satellite. I mean, I wonder if it's like just floating there, you know, turned off, just waiting for this moment.
Evidently, it's kind of in the middle of the country as opposed to the east or the west. And if they have to, they can even tip it one direction or the other, but they are hoping to get the regular East Coast satellite back online.
Yeah, I haven't checked, but I wonder if there's any more news about the Kepler. Have you heard anything about that?
No, I haven't yet, and I did look.
So they're probably just still trying to work things out.
Probably. And speaking of NASA, should they skip the asteroid and just go straight back to the moon? On Tuesday, May 21st, members of the U.S. House of Representatives Science, Space, and Technology Committee questioned the merit of NASA's project to capture an asteroid, and some called for a return to the moon instead of capturing an asteroid as a step towards Mars. Did you actually see anything about this?
Not really, no. So I'm a little confused here. Are they saying that they want to skip capturing an asteroid and work on going to the moon?
Some of the representatives were questioning whether capturing an asteroid was really a valid step towards Mars, and didn't it make perhaps more sense to set up a moon base that we could launch from, that we could train astronauts to be in a lower gravity, and many other benefits of that. It seemed to kind of slip under the radar, but I thought it was a pretty interesting discussion. And of course, there's a link to a full article in our show notes.
You know, I would think that it would make sense to, you know, work from the moon. It's almost like a training session before we actually step out toward Mars. That's, you know, my thoughts in general. And besides, if they do capture an asteroid and fling it around the moon, you know, work on mining that, there's a lot of great resources they can get from that. Plus, isn't there something that is on the moon that's very valuable?
Right, helium-3.
That's it, yeah.
Yes, and frankly, to be a bit nationalistic for a moment, we don't want the Chinese to kind of be the monopoly on that. I'm all for a moon base, personally.
Wow. So we might have, like, Moon War One.
It sounds like the stuff of science fiction, but Lord knows that one day it is, you know, the way we're going, a real possibility. Yeah, and to continue with some NASA news, they announced plans recently to allow commercial space companies to rent access to the historic Launch Pad 39A at the Kennedy Space Center. This arrangement will allow the agency to maintain the facility while giving newer space enterprises a more affordable way to launch their vehicles.
I think that's pretty green of them. What do you think?
I think it's pretty exciting, actually. And it makes so much sense that it's hard to believe a government agency came up with it.
Yeah. You know, it's probably because of their funding issues.
Oh, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. They just have to think out of the box a little more to try to make things work.
I honestly kind of wonder if the commercial companies didn't come to them and ask for it. But
that very well could be. That makes sense, actually. Yeah.
But I might be a little unfair to NASA. I can't pretend to really know their inner workings.
Well, just remember the conspiracy started here.
That's right.
Yeah.
And one more bit of space news here. The Herschel Space Observatory, which is a European space agency project with some NASA participation, has captured images of the collision of two galaxies approximately 11 billion light years from Earth. It has been suggested that collisions such as this are responsible for giant elliptical-shaped galaxies that were apparently common in the early stages of our universe.
Yeah, this is fascinating. I was following this, and you know, they're seeing starbursts. Actually, on the show notes, if you follow that link, you'll see some images of it. You know, to put a how vast just our galaxy on, you know, since this is a science-related podcast, you know, I was looking at it, 600,000 trillion miles across the Milky Way, which is about 100 or 120,000 light years. Isn't that amazing if you think about all the galaxies out there?
Yeah, and you know, the other thing that always gets me with things like this is when we're getting images from 11 billion light years away, those are images that are 11 billion years old.
That's right.
And that's just crazy to think about.
I remember the first time I stepped into an observatory and looked up at Andromeda. I was looking at light that took, you know, millions of years to get to that telescope lens. It's an amazing feeling when you really think about it.
It is. It's a bit humbling.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, to rebel against your science, the UPI reported last Friday, May 24th, on a UFO spotted over a California historic site. The Edgemoor Barn is now part of a museum complex in Santee, California, and has, according to the article, had ghost sightings in the past, but never a UFO. You can see the photograph of the oval flying object and a YouTube collage of photographs related to the sighting in the original UPI article. Like all of today's articles, you will find a link to it in our show notes. Did you get a chance to see that picture?
Oh, yes. It really does look disc-shaped. This was a photograph that was taken when they didn't even spot anything. He saw something on his viewer, and then when he put it on his computer and expanded it, he saw the disc-shaped item and didn't see it with the naked eye. And that, you know, that reminds me of, you know, some other things that have been taken like that. You know, for instance, I'm not going to talk about the Denver one because that one is controversial. But okay. There was a Chilean one a few years ago that was investigated, highly investigated, that was a video slowdown, and they saw, you know, objects. You know, maybe these things are just flying so fast, whatever they are, that they just can't be captured with the naked eye.
That's true. And also in this one, I didn't get the impression that he didn't see it. That because he was looking there, but it just he didn't notice it so much because he was taking pictures of this barn. No investigation. I am now making no claims of its legitimacy. But so far, it is my favorite UFO picture of the year, probably just because it's like classic saucery looking too.
Yeah, it really does have that shape. A few minutes ago, I was talking about the Chilean report, and
right.
I have some exciting news. Next week is going to be an awesome podcast. We have three people on that are just amazing. And the first one I'm going to talk about is Jose Lai. Now, he's the International Affairs Director of the Chilean government that investigates unidentified aerial phenomena or UFOs. He's going to be on. After him is Dr. Alexander Wendt. He talks about the militant agnosticism and the UFO taboo. Very interesting guy. And one I'm really excited about is General De Brouwer, the UFO wave over Belgium. We're going to have those three guests on in one podcast.
Wow. That is going to be a really, really interesting podcast.
I'm excited about it.
I mean, I vividly remember seeing De Brouwer on CNN during all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as vividly as I remember Norman Schwarzkopf and Desert Storm.
Yeah.
That honestly, that is something that if you know somebody who is kind of into UFOs or kind of on the fence and they don't listen to the show, get them to listen to that show because I think that's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, it's great. Well, thanks so much, Michael.
Well, thank you. And I look forward to your interview with Dr. Shostak.
You bet. I'm on Skype again with Seth Shostak. How are you, Seth?
Hi, Martin. I'm fine. Thank you.
Thanks for coming back after our debate last time. If someone wants to hear us debate about UFOs, they can go back to archived episode number 22. Basically, that debate was that you don't really think we're being visited by extraterrestrials, and I think it's possible. That's kind of in a nutshell. But one of the things we both agree on is, I believe we do anyway, is that we both believe that there is intelligent life out there somewhere. And so can you describe exactly what SETI has done and what it is doing today to try to find it?
Well, sure. The SETI Institute, which is, by the way, where I'm speaking to you from, located here in the Silicon Valley, is interested in life in space, and in fact, not just intelligent life in space. The majority of the scientists here are thinking about life that might not be terribly intelligent, but might be closer by, like life on Mars, some of the moons of Saturn and Jupiter, and so forth. So the majority of the scientists here actually are studying those sorts of questions. But there is also our SETI group. That's what the Institute is perhaps best known for. I'm part of that group. And the SETI group, although rather numerically small, is indeed trying to find some cosmic company by eavesdropping on radio signals. That's what we're looking for these days, although in the past we've looked for other kinds of signals. But radio signals, we're just trying to do what Jodie Foster did in the movie Contact and pick up some signals from space that would tell us that there's somebody out there at least clever enough to build a transmitter that we could hear.
Now, one of the things that just comes to mind, I know there's a lot of things I want to talk to you about because there's a lot going on in the field of astronomy in general. This is probably really a layman's question, but if Kepler happens to find an exoplanet that is possibly habitable, do you actually work with NASA to redirect, like, say, the Allen Telescope Array?
Yes. Well, that is the antenna that we're using for our SETI experiments, the Allen Telescope Array. In fact, we don't even have to work terribly closely with the NASA guys doing Kepler because many of our scientists here are involved directly with Kepler. They're working for Kepler. So it's sort of an inside connection. And indeed, when they find a possibly habitable world, of course, it's on our list. We're looking at many of the planet candidates. Most of them are candidates. They're not yet confirmed with the telescopes here on the ground, but many of the Kepler candidates. And you know, here's the bottom line. I mean, we found, one way or another, mostly through Kepler, something like 9 planets that might be habitable. Now, the number of confirmed planets that have been found in toto is like 900. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, there are thousands of additional candidates, but they haven't yet been confirmed. So let's be conservative. 900 planets found, 9 of them might be habitable. That sounds like 1%. Of all planets are habitable. Well, that's a very crude estimate because it's based on, you know, limited data so far. But, you know, that means there are going to be a lot of them out there, given that there are probably a trillion planets in the galaxy, then maybe 10 billion of them are habitable. But of course we look at them. Of course we do. Yes.
Yeah. I know there's the wobble on how they actually figure out how close this planet is, the mass of it and all that. And do you happen to know how they actually figure out if it's a rocky planet or instead of a gaseous one?
Well, yeah, you do that not so much because you can actually see that or even directly measure it. But what you can measure, depending on how you find the planet, of course, but what you can measure is its size. For example, if you're finding it with Kepler, because how does Kepler work? You know, it just stares at 150,000 stars. It just measures how bright each of those stars is, you know, roughly every 30 seconds it makes another measurement. It's like a giant light meter in space, okay? And if it sees that, wait a minute, this star, which was this brightness for days and days and days, suddenly got a little bit dimmer, you know, maybe one part in 10,000 dimmer. So it's a very small change, but it can measure that. And it gets dimmer for, you know, who knows, 5, 10 hours, and then it got brighter again. Then you say, well, something got in front of it. Something blocks some of the light from this thing, and that's a planet. Now, you assume that the planet's around because we don't find planets that are shaped like, I don't know, you know, pyramids or Mount Rushmore or anything like that. They're round, okay? You know the star's round, so that's just really a junior high school, middle school geometry to figure out how big the planet is. And if it's something the size of Jupiter, you know, everything we know about planets suggests it's probably like Jupiter. It's mostly a ball of gas. But if it's small, well, then it's likely to be a rocky planet. Now, the thing is that the other way of finding planets, where you just look at the wobble of the star, that gives you some idea of the mass, how heavy it is. So if you have the mass and you have the size, then you can work out, well, you know, what's the density of this thing? Is it like rock or is it like gas? Because there's quite a bit of difference in the density. And so, you know, using those kinds of techniques, you can occasionally tell, frequently tell, actually whether the planet is likely to be a rocky planet like the Earth, which is, you know, pretty solid, or it's some sort of gas ball like, you know, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, or Neptune.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard the company named SkyTree is going to be helping sort through the data. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know exactly what SkyTree is going to do. There are all sorts of ways of sorting through this data. The Kepler data are publicly available, many of them. Of the data are. And so people have been looking through them, people who aren't actually connected with the Kepler project directly, but they go through it and look at, for example, how many planets are being found around a certain kind of star. There was a team at Harvard, the Center for Astrophysics at Harvard, that did this, and Courtney Dressing and David Charbonneau. And what they found was, for example, something very interesting, that something like 6% of all the red dwarf stars, these are the tiniest stars in the universe, that 6% of them have planets that might be habitable. That's amazing. If that holds up, and it looks pretty good, if that holds up, I mean, these are, three quarters of all stars are these little red dwarf guys. And if 6% of them have habitable planets, again, that's billions of habitable planets just in our galaxy. So those are the kinds of things that you can use the Kepler data for. I mean, it's being used by many people looking for many different things.
It almost makes you feel not so special to be Earth when you hear that data. Can we talk about, I think it was back in 77 or whenever it was, the WOW signal. When did you start working at SETI?
Well, I didn't start working here at the SETI Institute till about 1990, 1991. Mm-hmm. I had done a SETI experiment in 1981. I was living in Europe at the time. I wasn't here in this country in 77 when the WOW signal was indeed found. But I know something about it because, of course, it's become famous. And it's become mm-hmm. famous, of course, because it has a really nifty name, mostly.
Yeah. Can you talk about what that was and if anything sure. else has happened similar to that?
Well, yes. As it turns out, it was 1977, and at that time, Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, had a very large radio telescope. They called it the Big Ear. It was a very special design. It wasn't your usual, parabola aimed at the sky. It was a big reflector, a couple of big reflectors sort of perpendicular to the ground or almost perpendicular to the ground. In any case, this thing was huge. It was in one dimension, I think it was like 400 feet, so a pretty big thing. But it wasn't so useful for radio astronomy research anymore because it had been superseded by other instruments. And so it was being used for SETI. It was just sort of turned on every day, and the sky sort of passed overhead as the Earth rotated. It was, sort of in this automatic mode. And every morning, the astronomers would walk into the control room, and there'd be a big stack of computer printout on big, wide paper, which is the way things were done in 1977. And one morning, Jerry Amon, one of the astronomers there, walked in, and he looked through the paper printout, as he did every day, and there was this big signal. And he wrote WOW next to it. So that's how it got the name, WOW signal. And it was seen that one time, and it had the characteristics of a signal that's actually coming from the sky, not from one spot on the sky, part of the sky that's moving at the same speed across the sky as the heavens do because of the rotation of the Earth, not like a satellite or something like that. So it fit all the requirements for being ET. And so it became quite famous. Now, several things. To begin with, that antenna had an automatic reobservation 70 seconds later because it was essentially a second receiver on it. And so it was looked at again 70 seconds, just a little over a minute later and not seen. And it has never been seen since with other antennas. So, hey, nobody knows what it was. It might have been ET. It might have been interference. Nobody knows. If you don't see it a second time, if you can't confirm it, then you certainly can't claim that it was ET. All you can say is, well, this was a mystery signal. It's certainly not the only one. In the early days of SETI, there would be hundreds of these things found. I mean, there are whole drawers full of these things. They just didn't have nifty names.
Oh, I see. What is the process for when you think you have found a signal? What do you do at that point?
Well, if you think you found a signal, and you find signals all the time, by the way, this is a misconception mostly promulgated by the movies, in which it looks like people just sit around, there's nothing, 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 and then suddenly they hear something, and they get excited. Mm-hmm. You get signals all the time. I mean, you have these big antennas, and you have receivers listening to millions of channels at any given time, so of course you pick up signals. And the only question is, well, is this signal really ET, or is this just, more interference from Earth? And so there are all sorts of automated tests you can do. You check the frequency against a known database of interference. And, we've worked out over the years all sorts of automated tests that the computers can do, because you don't want to have humans doing this, it's very tedious, to rule out most of these signals right away as being interference. Some of them still look good, and then you have to do other kinds of tests, which the computers can still do, such as, all right, you're pointed at some spot on the sky, you're picking up a signal, and so the obvious thing to do is just move the antenna a little bit so it's not looking at that same spot on the sky, look away from it a little bit. The signal should go away, unless it's interference. If it's interference, you'll pick it up no matter where you point, because it's usually so strong that, you know, it just overwhelms the antenna. So if you point away and it goes away, and then you move the antenna back to whatever star system you were pointing at, and the signal comes back, you say, well, that's interesting, and you keep doing that. That's all automatic. If all of that continues to look good, right, then, you know, what you do is at some point, the computers essentially give up. They throw up their little computer hands, and they call the astronomer in. They say, look, I don't know, but this thing still looks good. At which point, you know, you do similar tests. I mean, you just keep moving the antenna around and try and make sure that it's really coming from one spot on the sky that's, again, moving across the sky at the speed at which, you know, the Earth rotates. If that still looks good, then you'd call up somebody at another observatory and say, you look at it, you know, because you got to be sure that it isn't just a bug in your system somehow. So, you know, that's what you would do. We've never quite gotten to that step. We almost have on one or two occasions. But in general, we've been able to figure out, oh, no, it is interference in every other case. So that's what you would do. And if somebody else finds it, too, you know, at that point, it's a real story.
No, so this is monitored around the clock by computers. How, or computers and people as yourself?
There are people always in the background, right? I mean, the computers in general don't call on the people. Because they can work it out themselves. I mean, you know, to sit there and just, you can't possibly look at all the data yourself. I mean, you know, we monitor more than 50 million channels, so there's no way you can even display this on a screen. The computers are doing all the analysis. And if they find something that is persistent that passes all these tests, you do hear about it. Yes, of course, it could, you know, it tells you. So, but that's a very infrequent occurrence, actually. Yeah.
So what does someone like you or other scientists actually do when there's nothing going on at SETI?
try and raise money in order to pay for the whole thing.
That's
a lot of it. But also, I mean, just thinking about, you know, well, what experiment should we be doing? I mean, where should we point the antennas? That happens to be an interest of mine. I mean, these days, we're pointing at all these Kepler candidates, of course, but also at the center of the galaxy, the galactic center, we're looking at a series of small area near the galactic center, because, you know, the galaxy's been around for at least 13 billion years, and that means that if societies spring up on a routine basis, then there are societies out there that have had billions of years head start on us, and a really advanced society might put, you know, some sort of big beacon, some big transmitter down near the center of the galaxy, because they know that everybody in the galaxy will eventually look toward the center. That's the one spot everybody knows about.
Wow.
Whether or not they've ever gotten the you know, galactic newsletter from the aliens.
Never thought of that. So do you actually frequent that one area?
You know, there have been experiments. My first SETI experiment was actually looking at the galactic center. That was in 1981. That was using an antenna in Europe. But there have been a handful anyhow, of experiments to look at the galactic center. But it always pays to look again with new equipment, because you might cover, I mean, in our case, we can cover parts of the radio dial that haven't been examined before for signals. So it's interesting. And by the way, to be quite candid, I mean, the galactic center is such an interesting part of the galaxy that often when you study it, you find something new in astronomy. And, you know, maybe it's not ET, but you found something that you didn't know about. Because this is a giant black hole down there. There's a lot of hot gas. There's a high concentration of stars. And it's really the downtown area of the Milky Way.
Right. You mentioned funding just a minute ago. Where does SETI get their funding today?
Well, the SETI Institute, of course, gets funding various ways. Most of the people who are doing the astrobiology research, people studying Mars or the moons of Jupiter or Saturn, they're entrepreneurial. They put in proposals to various granting agencies, mostly NASA, overwhelmingly NASA. And, you know, they say they're going to study this or that particular aspect of, I don't know, the hydrology of Mars, just to give you an example. And if the granting agency figures, you know, these guys are competent, this is an interesting thing to do, then give them a certain amount of money. So they self-fund. And they also, of course, there's a bit of an overhead cost. In other words, whatever money they bring in, a certain percentage of it goes to the Institute, which is providing them with an office and, you know, a phone and light bulbs and a computer and all that stuff. And that overhead also pays for salaries of the administration, even people like me. So that's the majority of the money that comes in that way. For SETI, there is no government funding. There are no government, no tax dollars involved, and so it's all donations. And that makes it hard because even though the total amount of money being spent on SETI is rather small, it has to be raised simply by donations, and that's a hard thing to do.
I bet. And when did the government stop funding it? They did for a while, right? For quite a while.
Yes. When I joined the SETI Institute, it had been a NASA project for on the order of 15 years. It was mostly small, but it got larger, and at one point it actually came to close to $10 million a year. For a year or two. Yeah. But that, and so that allowed them to build the equipment and get all set up on some big antennas for doing some serious SETI research. But that was killed exactly 20 years ago. In 1993, the fall of 1993, actually, Congress passed a resolution. This was the initiative of a senator from Nevada, passed an initiative to kill SETI, the NASA SETI program. So that's when it ended. October 1993.
And did it just keep going immediately under funding of someone, of privates?
Some of it did. There was a big survey of the sky looking for signals that was being run out of the Jet Propulsion Lab, JPL, down in Pasadena. All that just went away. Mm. There was no money. We were able to save part of the SETI program, the NASA SETI program, the so-called targeted search, by raising some private money. The SETI Institute did that. The SETI Institute, of course, is just an independent nonprofit research organization. So, of course, if they could find money to do something, they could do it.
Mm-hmm. What is your opinion, Seth, if SETI discovered life out there and it was certain, what do you think would happen in general with society?
Well, unlike many people, I don't think that this would cause rioting in the streets and so forth and so on. I get emails every second day from people who think that we're keeping secrets because the government is afraid that if we were to tell people that we knew about aliens, either here or there, that the public couldn't handle that news. Well, that's kind of hard to believe, given the fact that, you know, in the past, 100 years ago, people believed there were canals on Mars, mm-hmm. and nobody seemed to get terribly upset about it. Didn't stop things like the First World War or anything like that. It just kept, people just said, oh, that's kind of interesting. Gosh, there's this vast society on Mars. So, in fact, I think that the reaction, we've seen this over and over. I mean, the 1996 announcement of life on Mars due to this Martian meteorite, people found it interesting. They certainly didn't riot in the streets. And even if we found a signal, obviously, okay, fine. They don't know that we're listening in, so there's no danger there. They would just find it interesting. What would happen, of course, is it would become a very big story. And I think that the money problems would kind of go away because people would want to build very much bigger instruments so that they could study that signal and see if there's any message on it. Because obviously you'd want to know, are they saying anything? I mean, should we pay attention? That kind of thing. And you'd look for a second one. Having found one, you'd probably find the second one much more quickly because you know much better what you're looking for. So it would stimulate all sorts of additional research. And I think the public would just find it interesting. There's been a little bit of study as to how it would affect religion and so forth. And most of the major religions wouldn't have any problem with this idea that, there's somebody out there. There are some suggestions that fundamentalist believers would have troubles because this is not predicted in the Bible. And consequently, they would question whether the discovery was true or not.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know the Vatican has accepted that it's most likely. They have quite an astronomy connection themselves. Is it Mount Graham or something like that, the binocular telescope?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the Vatican has its own observatory, and they have their own telescope and so forth. And they indeed have even had conferences on the idea of intelligent life in space. So there's no problem for the Vatican with this. That might not have been true 100 or 200 years ago, It's true today. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, and the same with the other so-called atomist religions, Christianity and Judaism. They've all, if you talk to theologians in those, for those two religions, they all say, look, this is perfectly acceptable. We don't have any problem with it. Now, That's easy to say, and I think that the actual reaction depends on what you learn. If you can't figure out the message or you can't pick up the message because of technical limitations, then that's a little different than if you can. If you can actually understand what's being said, and that's probably a long shot, but if you could, that might change things because imagine that the Native Americans were invaded by the Spaniards in 1492 and, never understood anything about what they were saying and never really had any physical contact with them. They just knew that they were there. That would have been a lot different experience for them than actually interacting with these guys. So, to say that everybody can handle this story without any problem, yes, that seems to be the case. But if you can ultimately figure out what the message is, that might change things because it would be coming from a very much more advanced society than our own.
You mentioned something similar just a minute ago about Stephen Hawking's attitude that we might be in dangerous territory looking out there.
Well, Stephen Hawking didn't say that it was dangerous to look. In fact, he made a point of saying that that's not dangerous. But what is potentially dangerous, in his opinion, is that if you broadcast something back, if you broadcast and sort of let them know we're here, since you don't know anything about their inclinations, their temperament, their behavior, you got to be careful because if they're very advanced, they might just take advantage of you. Well, that's certainly true here on Earth. That's been sort of the history of various societies on Earth when a less advanced society meets a more advanced society, at least from a technical point of view. But on the other hand, we've been broadcasting into space since the Second World War. Our television, mainly our radar, and so forth. And, those signals are on their way out into space. They're 70 light years into space, the earliest of them. And you might say, oh, yeah, but they're very weak. They're a lot different than broadcasting deliberately. Hi, hey, we're the Earthlings, and we just picked up your message, and we just love to get in touch. That could be a much stronger signal. There's no doubt about that. But on the other hand, any society that actually could be dangerous, any society that could come here, it's really easy to show that they will have the kind of equipment that could pick up our leakage. So, it's too late to worry about that. You can worry about it if you want, but it's too late to suddenly decide, oh, well, we better be quiet. Besides, being quiet has an enormous cost on society because there are all sorts of things you can no longer do then. And as a result, it's a very interesting thing to say, oh, gosh, we ought to be careful about broadcasting into space. But that, that bell has been rung.
And you can't unring it.
Nope.
Well, lately it seems like there's a lot of exciting breakthroughs in astronomy, a lot of discoveries and things like that. What's the most exciting thing to you that's happening?
Well, there are various things, but I think that hands down the most exciting thing is still the discovery of new planets, and in particular Kepler, is a very simple idea that's having an enormous payoff. There was an announcement about a week or two ago about a couple of new planets that might be habitable. I like the idea that two of them might be in the same solar system, two planets that are habitable in the same solar system. It's unclear whether we have that. Probably we do in our solar system. But if you had two sort of Earth-like worlds in a single solar system, then if there were really any inhabitants there, intellectual inhabitants, they would colonize both of those worlds for sure. Hmm. And, if those two worlds kind of line up with Earth, which occasionally they will do, then, you're sort of looking down the communication pipeline between those two planets. And I think that's a great time to look for SETI signals because you may just intercept them. So that's kind of interesting. The discovery of new worlds, finally, getting a better hold on what fraction of stars have planets that really are sort of like the Earth. That's what Kepler is designed to answer. And it looks like it's going to answer that question probably within a year or two. So, I find that exciting. Some of the other things speak to my earlier interests of mine. In particular, I used to study galaxies. So I'm interested in dark matter. We had done some of the early experiments that showed dark matter existed. And there are now experiments being conducted by physicists to actually look for dark matter and figure out what it is. That would be very interesting to know what it is. Yeah.
Wasn't there something on the International Space Station where they just had a breakthrough in dark matter?
Well, not that I know of. It's hard to have a breakthrough in dark matter because, look, you don't know what dark matter is. And in order to figure out, the best guess are that it's some sort of still undiscovered fundamental particle or some some particle, okay? And so probably what you need to find that would be something like the Large Hadron Collider, all right? And they're certainly trying. There are other experiments being considered too, but it's, you know, so that would be interesting. The other sorts of experiments that would be very interesting and haven't had any success so far are experiments that might be able to show you whether, for example, there's any truth to string theory. I mean, is it for real or is it just, you know, a lot of mathematics? Mm-hmm. You can look for cosmic strings and stuff like that. So these are all experiments that are going on. If you could find out more about string theory, that would be a tremendous breakthrough. The other big puzzle, of course, is dark energy. Mm-hmm. Dark energy, and their experiments being planned. Again, it's hard to do these things, but to learn more about at least the characteristics of dark energy, because dark energy is the number one component of the universe. We have no idea what it is.
Right. In your opinion, do you think that SETI will actually find life within a period of time?
Well, within a period of time, I think yes. I think that SETI can succeed. I think it will succeed myself, but all right, that's just my opinion, and that doesn't really count for much. I mean, only the data count in science. Are the data good? Are the data convincing? And I think that there really is a good chance, simply because SETI keeps getting better as equipment gets better. In particular, computation gets less expensive. That really speeds up the search because you can look through more of the radio dial. You can look at more stars. You can do all of this without building new antennas, but simply by increasing your compute power. And since that's an ongoing technological improvement, we see it, you know, every couple of years, you can go buy a new computer that's twice as fast as the one you have. That's reflected in what we're doing. And consequently, I think that there's a good chance that we will succeed. It could be that we're the smartest things in the galaxy. I know a lot of my neighbors like to think that, but... They might be wrong.
I think they probably are. You mentioned earlier that some people think that SETI is keeping secrets. Can you tell us how long it would take to say if you had a confirmation that the press would actually know about it?
Oh, that takes no time.
Really?
Okay. Because the press starts calling long before you've even considered how to confirm anything. I mean, we've had that experience. This is another kind of rebuttal to people who think you guys would keep it all secret. We wouldn't learn about it. Well, experience shows that that's nonsense, and it is nonsense to begin with. There's no policy here. I mean, if you're going to keep secrets, somebody ought to tell you, by the way, if you find something, keep it secret. Nobody's ever said that, so nobody does. Mm-hmm. And whenever we get a signal, immediately the press start calling, immediately, long before you've had a chance to figure out whether it's, you know, interference or ET. I mean, it's going to be in the papers. There are going to be all sorts of false alarms in the papers because there's no secrecy.
How does the press find out about a signal?
Well, people just tell them, basically. I mean, what happens is that if you find a signal that looks interesting, everybody starts writing their friends, you know, email, everybody involved in the experiment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, the friends tell their friends, and somebody puts it on their blog, and, you know, it's... I mean, in the past, we've had people that just call up the New York Times and whatever. So, yeah, there's no secrecy. That's unfortunate in some sense because it does mean that there are going to be these false alarms, and you know, you don't really want a whole lot of false alarms because it's sort of, I don't know, it infringes on the credibility of the experiment when you keep crying wolf. But it isn't that we're actually crying wolf. It's just that we found something interesting and people immediately want to know about it. This has happened many times, by the way. You can find all sorts of stories in the press about how we found a signal. I mean, legitimate stories, not the sort of conspiracy stories. Where we indeed thought that, hey, this is an interesting signal, but you know, you check them out a little farther or a little further, and then it turns out that they're not for real. But there is no secrecy. There's no policy of it, and there's no way to keep it secret anyhow.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. And is it SETI.org?
SETI.org.
So you must get a heck of a lot of emails, Seth, and it's right on that site.
Yep, my email address is very easy to find, and every day 500 people find it. So.
It was probably a little boring to you not debating flying saucers this time, but I really do appreciate you coming back on.
It was my pleasure, Martin.